Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today, a special conversation on Juneteenth, as we observe it as a federal holiday for the second year. From 1865 to today, the history, importance, significance, and celebration of a new holiday that's nearly 160 years old, marking what might have been, should have been, the end of one of the worst chapters in American history, but wasn't. Last week, we invited three guests to sit down with us and reflect on Juneteenth, both as Professor Kelly Carter Jackson once explained it to me, the delay and the delight of a holiday's history and present. Kelly Carter Jackson is one of those three. She is Associate Professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. We also invited Renee Graham, opinion columnist and associate editor for the Boston Globe, to join us, as well as Joel Christian Gill, a cartoonist, historian, and associate professor at Massachusetts College of Art and Design. All have joined us on Radio Boston in the past to reflect on Black life in America, Black history, and the racial arc of the country since the 2020 murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police. Kelly, Renee, Joel, welcome to all of you. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
It's great.
So glad to be here.
It's great to have you here. And I'm going to start by asking each of you to share a little bit about what Juneteenth means personally for you. And Renee, why don't I invite you to go first?
I mean, I've celebrated Juneteenth really almost as long as I can remember. And to me, it's one of the great days in American history. It was always odd to me that it wasn't more widely celebrated, because it's the moment when, at least for me, that America becomes a country, that America becomes whole, or at least the promise of becoming whole. So it's long overdue. It's egregiously overdue, but I'm glad it's here, and I hope people treat it with the respect that it deserves.
Kelly, how about you?
So I did not grow up in Texas, but I did my last 2 years of high school there. And so that's when I was sort of first introduced to the holiday, and going to Juneteenth parades and barbecues, cookouts, all of that. And it became more a part of my life as an adult. And now that I'm a parent with young children, it's very much a part of our lives. And I look forward to celebrating it with them and really getting a chance to talk about the history of Juneteenth on a level that, you know, meets their age appropriateness. But it's always been a conflicted time for me, because it's a joy. It's a delight, like I said before, but it's also a delay. It's also, you know, significant in that it signals to this mix of emotions. But I always look forward to celebrating, that's for sure.
How about you, Joel?
I grew up in Southwestern Virginia, and I don't think I even knew what Juneteenth was until I was in high school. We didn't celebrate it very much, and which is really interesting, because I was talking to my mom randomly. My mom's 75, and I was talking about, like, during the protests, how we were talking about we're going to get a national holiday, which I have thoughts on that. In addition, later on, I'll express. But we're going to get this national holiday, and I'm like, well, we didn't celebrate Juneteenth. And my mom was like, well, we always celebrated it. And it dawned on me that, you know, she went to a segregated school. She went to a predominantly Black school. And so, like, Black history wasn't relegated to a month for her. It was 365 days out of the year. And so, like, just the idea that I never celebrated it struck me as, like, the epitome of the problem with what happened during desegregation. Well, in the real word, assimilation, right? Like, Black people who went to, you know, segregated schools learned this stuff, and I didn't. So in a lot of ways, that made me a little angry. So, like, that's kind of how I feel about it in terms of, like, you know, we could have been celebrating this, but we weren't able to.
So I do think, and you, all three of your reflections touch on this again a little bit, Kelly's framing of delay and delight, usually delight and delay, but I'm going to start with delay this time, is actually a useful way to set up at least a piece of this conversation. And I want to do that. But in order to do that, I think we have to go back and do the actual history. And Kelly, you've done that in the past. You're quite good at it. Why don't I have you start for us there? Take us back to 1865 and explain again what Juneteenth is in its historical context.
Sure. So I'm actually going to take it back to 1863, because I think it's really important to know about the Emancipation Proclamation, which frees all of the states that are in, frees all of the enslaved people that are in states that are in rebellion. So there are four states that are actually still a part of the Union, but they're slaveholding states that aren't a part of the Emancipation Proclamation. But that proclamation frees about 3 million of the 4 million people enslaved, which is a huge, huge number. And those other states that are border states, that are slave states within the Union, eventually they wind up freeing their enslaved population as well. Texas knows about this, but it's essentially holding on to its enslaved property until Union troops can get to Texas and basically make this a military mandate. And so for 2 years, until June 19th of 1865, enslaved people, some of them who know that they are free but cannot sort of flee from the grip of the planter still, and some of them who don't know that they're free at all, find that out on June 19th. And it is a huge celebration when General Gordon Granger arrives to Galveston, Texas, and basically gives his decree and says, hey, listen, you know, all of you enslaved people are now henceforth forever free.
And how does that celebration then spread?
Oh, I mean, it spreads all over the country, but in Texas, it's a really big deal. You know, in the first generation out of slavery, you know, you have these former enslaved communities that are fundraising, that are buying large plots of land, that are using this land to celebrate this holiday. It's a moment where people came together. It was a big time of reunions as well, because if you think about the end of slavery, the first thing families are doing is, I got to find my mother, I need to find my brother, I need to find my sister. So it's a moment of enslaved people trying to find one another again. And then in doing that, having these big celebrations and, you know, speeches, and the church is very much a part of this as well. Their parades, their festivals. And those traditions have pretty much kept up all throughout the century and lead us to where we are today.
Almost 160 years later. Joel, I'm mindful of you expressing that anger that as a kid you didn't learn what you might have learned otherwise. Is this the history you know? Is this the history you eventually learned?
Yeah, this is exactly the history that I eventually learned. And, you know, to put a finer point on it, you know, as much as I think Juneteenth is a necessary celebration, and I think we should be celebrating it, it's almost like cake for prisoners, right? Like we're asking to be free and you're giving us cake. And I think that's probably my biggest issue with the idea of taking, you know, of a national holiday for Juneteenth, because we're saying Voting Rights Act and, you know, renew the Voting Rights Act and do these other things. And, you know, think about mass incarceration and the police reform. But, you know, and we talk about Juneteenth and, you know, in Juneteenth, you know, like in and of itself, just the idea of it is a representation of how America has never kept its promise to Black people. Mm-hmm. Even 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, Black people are free, but it's mostly free-ish, right? Because it takes the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, which has both of all of those amendments, specifically the 15th Amendment, has been completely gutted over the last probably, you know, 50 years or so. And we had a brief period in which we were actually doing those things. And so instead of really dealing with these underlying problems, this is kind of how America tends to work. We are, you know, we say there's a problem, we get Juneteenth, right? We say there's a problem with, you know, mass incarceration, we get Dr. King's holiday. Like, stop giving us holidays and start giving us real things. That's like, that's typically my issue. Not necessarily like I have a problem with Juneteenth in and of itself. I just feel like it's a distraction from some of the realer issues that we are facing. While Juneteenth is a really important holiday, and I don't wanna devalue that. It's just that I would much rather be free than have the cake, if that makes sense.
It does. And you've sort of, to some extent, Joel, laid out a blueprint for what we can talk about, right, going forward in this hour. I want to pick up on the very first piece of it. And as I turn to you, Renee, I'm going to play a little sound from a conversation I had here on Radio Boston last year around this time with author Annette Gordon-Reed, who's a Harvard faculty member and author of the book On Juneteenth. And she is talking here about what happens next for enslaved people after the Juneteenth Declaration. Here she is.
With Juneteenth, slavery ended, but another series of travails began. So it's, you know, it's a happy day. We can't minimize how those people felt when they learned that legalized slavery, in which they were, you know, bought and sold, separated from their families, all those kinds of things, no longer existed. But we are also mindful of the fact that this was the beginning of another set of struggles that the freed people had to endure.
Let me just let you pick it up from there, Renee.
You know, I understand what she's saying. And it's interesting. I never needed a federal holiday to celebrate Juneteenth, you see. And the issue I have, and it's really not with the holiday, it was how it came about. If George Floyd isn't murdered, then we don't get this holiday. And so that makes it feel like a kind of consolation prize. You know, it's like, well, this thing happened and we feel bad, but here's a holiday. Or this thing happened, we're going to take Aunt Jemima off the bottle. It was all these really weird little performative things that still didn't really address the issues people have been talking about for years, the issues that led very directly to George Floyd's murder and Breonna Taylor's killing and Ahmaud Arbery's murder. I mean, it didn't address any of those things, but there's always a sense that if people are still standing over here and saying, as Joel was saying, you know, but we want voting rights and we want an end to mass incarceration, what you get is, yeah, but we gave you Juneteenth.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, it's the symbolic versus the structural. It's so easy to give these symbolic tokens of name changes, or we take down a flag, or, you know, we add a new street name that or change up a building's name, something like that. Those things cost very, very little. But mass incarceration, police brutality, those things are incredibly costly. And so it's, you know, as King said, it's civil rights on the cheap. I mean, this is the most affordable, quickest, easiest way to give people things that will, you know, satiate the masses.
Well, it's like when everyone started painting this, you know, Black Lives Matter on the street, you know, and it was like, what is that supposed to accomplish? Like, what does that mean? You've painted that, but your policies still say that you don't believe that Black Lives Matter, but we're supposed to be happy with this painting, you know, on the street.
Yeah, and I think that's like the crux of the problem, right? The history of racial justice in America has been painted as a line where we are getting a little bit ahead every time. But for every step forward, we take a step back. When non-Black people in a quote unquote Christian country are killed in a church, what do we do? We take a flag down. We don't enact any sort of legislation. When a man tried to catch his shoes on fire on a plane, we all have to take our shoes off, right? We actually enact real things, right? When, when people bombed the World Trade Center, we got real change, right? We got a real sort of change. Terrible change, but we did get some enacted thing. But if things happen to Black people in this country, what do we get? We get cake, right? We get cake. Mm-hmm. We don't get freedom. We don't get any real structural changes. We get cake. And it's just like, you know, and I can say this, and, you know, reality, like I am sitting in a quote unquote ivory tower, right? I am not, you know, where I grew up from, you know, the Southwestern Virginia projects, I'm no longer there. But at the same time, I can't divorce myself from those people, because it only takes one Supreme Court decision to make sure that I'm no longer a person, right? They've already taken these things away. And so, like, and they're saying, well, everything's fine now. You got Juneteenth and Martin Luther King Day. You got Black History Month. Like, take that all away and just give me the 15th Amendment, right? Like, really focus on the 15th Amendment. Really focus on the Ninth Amendment.
Give the 14th. Citizenship.
Citizenship, right? Like, let's focus on the, you know, like it, you know, like if you look at progress in America, it has not come from like holidays, right? It took an entire war for us to realize the promise of freedom for all people. And then another 60 years before most of you on this call were able to vote. Right. And then another, you know, 50, 40 years for the rest of us to be able to vote. And all those times we had the 15th Amendment, we had the 14th Amendment, we had the 13th Amendment, but we had people who were not utilizing those things. Right. And so we have, like, in this country, which people say we have a right and a left. We don't have a right and a left. We have a center right and a center. We do not have a left party in this country. And we have these, but we have these policies that we have, like, I'm sorry, I'm going to get on soapbox. I'm
and we have time. In a minute, though, I'm going to go to a break. So just to pick up on the things that you just said, Joel, I want to give both Renee and Kelly a chance to just rip. So Renee, you first.
You know, what it makes me think of is something I read once when I was a kid, that the definition of diplomacy is saying good dog until you can find a big enough stick. That's what this is. You know, it's always being pacified. It's always being patronized, but it's never moving the needle, you know? And so we have Juneteenth, but now we have all these laws in schools that mean you can't teach anything about why Juneteenth exists.
That's the irony. That's the irony.
Exactly.
And almost simultaneously, right? Because you get this holiday and then the whole critical race theory tirade comes at the exact same time. It is not a coincidence that we have made this a holiday and simultaneously push back on the teaching of African-American history or the history of marginalized peoples.
All right. It's okay for Black kids to go into Robert E. Lee High School or Andrew Jackson High School, but it's not little okay for little white kids to hear that some dead white dude did some horrible things to Black people. Like, make it make sense.
All right. Yeah. So on that note, we're going to take a quick break. Joel Christian Gill, Renee Graham, Kelly Carter Jackson, stay with us. Much more, many threads from what you've just said that we will pick up on when we get back from a great break. I am Tiziana Dearing. You are listening to a special hour of Radio Boston on Juneteenth. Stay tuned. There's more ahead. You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and we're reflecting on Juneteenth today. It's history, import, symbolism of its journey to recognition, and more. With us, Renee Graham of the Boston Globe, Wellesley Professor Kelly Carter Jackson, and Massachusetts College of Art and Design Professor Joel Christian Gill. Before the break, we were having a conversation about one step forward, but not really forward. Joel, you had referred to Juneteenth as cake. You want freedom, you get cake. And just before the break, Kelly, you were talking about the fact that there's no accident that something like a pushback of teaching race in schools comes in hand in hand with the kind of step forward that a Juneteenth would be. So I want to pick up on that, and I'm also going to sort of ask the pushback question that you know people then ask, given the conversation you just had, which is, has there been no progress? Has there been no step forward? So, Kelly, I'm going to pick your voice back up again. Finish that thought about this is no accident. The moment that we're in is no accident. Mm-hmm. Start there.
It's definitely no accident that there's constant pushback to Black progress. And that's been consistent from the moment Black people were enslaved to the moment Black people were freed. There's constant pushback to Black humanity and Black liberation, no question. Has there been progress? Yes and no, right? I mean, I think that in some ways, when I think about what my ancestors lived through, they would certainly look at my life and be like, what? You know, like they would certainly see that as progress. But I do think that we have a tendency to believe that history is on a constant march towards bigger, better, more progressive. And that is just absolutely not true. Nothing that we see as change or progressive in this country is inevitable. None of it just comes from people just living their lives and all of a sudden they decide to do right. It all requires constant activism. It all requires constantly having people holding those in power, holding their feet to the fire. And, you know, I think we have to keep doing that. We can't be satisfied with trinkets and with holidays and with, you know, flags changed or names changed. It has to be policy oriented. It has to be meaningful for people who are living their lives on the ground and at the bottom.
So, Renee, I saw some nodding there. So before I ask any more questions, let me just turn it over to you to pick up on that.
I mean, I agree with absolutely everything Kelly said. There is this sense in this country always, if you get emancipation, then you have Reconstruction, but then you have Jim Crow. If you have Barack Obama, then you get Donald Trump. There is always backlash for even the slightest bit of progress in this country. Mm-hmm. You have to be pushed, but you're not going to get pushed back to where you were. You're going to get pushed back even further. Mm-hmm. So if you think of where we were, say, in 2016 in this country and where we are today, and as we're watching the hearings of January 6th, which we all know was essentially a white supremacist insurrection that's been building for years, there's always pushback. That's the thing. And so what we saw with Juneteenth, that it wasn't enough, fine, you got a holiday, that now we have to wipe out the history. So then you take the holiday and you kind of gut it. Then it really means nothing because you can't even talk about what it represents.
So Kelly, just quickly before you pick up on that. So Renee, just to clarify, when you say 2016 versus today, in that case, you're referring to a more mainstream emergence of white supremacism in our political sphere, et cetera. Is that right?
I mean, the hood's coming off completely. Yes. Mm.
Okay, Kelly. Mm.
I was just going to say real quickly that the interesting thing about Black history is that when Black people get structural change, there is structural pushback. When Black people get symbolic change, there is still structural pushback. So even the progress can't meet the pushback because the pushback leads to real policy changes where the symbolic can't get us that much further down the road.
If you have cancer for, you know, 5 years and you get chemo and you're feeling better, but you're not in remission, are you actually cancer-free? You're not, right? We are living in Malcolm X's idea. Like the knife has been pulled out 6 inches and people are saying that's progress, right? Like I am under no illusions that, you know, like constant planned violence is something that, you know, my grandparents had to deal with and my mother and my father had to deal with. But I have constant police violence that I have to deal with. I still have that thing, right? We still have Black mortality rates in healthcare and women. Doctors are doing to Black women what police are doing to Black men. We have all of these things. If we are all better, why did COVID hit Black people harder than it hit everyone else? Like, so like, this is a thing. Like we talk about these things as progress and people say, well, we don't have segregation anymore, right? Well, I mean, why are there still Black neighborhoods? There's still predominantly Black schools in America that are underfunded, right? It's race neutral now. We just use property taxes, right? If Black people are 13.3% of the population, why do we only own 2.3% of the wealth in America, right? Why is there still 40% of the population in prisons, nonviolent prisoners? Are 40% of the population are Black people. There is definitely a problem. It's just shifted. We've traded the Ku Klux Klan for the police state. We put Black faces in positions of power. It's almost like saying, I am mad at McDonald's that they will not change the recipe, so I am putting in a new cashier. That's what we're dealing with.
So I just want to reintroduce everyone for our listeners who may be joining us. We are having a conversation about Juneteenth. You were just listening to Joel Christian Gill, who's a cartoonist, historian, and associate professor at Mass College of Art and Design, and joining us from Hawaii. Every once in a while, Joel, your sound's just a tiny bit glitchy, so I want people to know why, because you're joining us from far away for this conversation. Also, Renee Graham, opinion columnist and associate editor of the Boston Globe, and Kelly Carter Jackson, associate professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. So, you know, I want to call a piece that Joel just set out. Joel just talked about a police state, right? Is that fair, Renee? And listen, I am well aware of the data, the research, the history, and our new powered by cell phone public awareness of the history of police anti-Black violence. I also am aware that we didn't put any voices on this show today that would say, wait, we don't live in a police state. So every once in a while, I'm going to jump in and say, well, let's interrogate that a little bit. As we have seen some moves, for example, in the city of Boston and in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts towards making some reforms on policing, you know, new certification, some restrictions, putting on body cameras, et cetera. Do you have any faith, Renee, that we are beginning to develop a public will for reforms that would create a less violent America to live in if you are Black?
No.
And why?
Well, let's go back to what happened to George Floyd. What Derek Chauvin did to George Floyd, he felt empowered to do, not only to murder this man while in front of witnesses, he expected to get away with it, because police have so often gotten away with it. And let's not also forget, the first statement the Minneapolis Police Department put out said, man has medical incident during police interaction. That was the story. Mm. So the idea that what Derek Chauvin did, that he expected to get away with it, that the Minneapolis Police Department was completely complicit in allowing him to get away with it. If not for Darnella Frazier's video, then we never really know what happens to George Floyd. That is, to me, in some ways, the definition of a police state. When you feel empowered to essentially kill a man under your knee in front of witnesses, staring right at them, then that to me does say it's a police state.
And can I say, even with George Floyd, we saw this all publicly. But to me, what's even more egregious is Breonna Taylor, because she was sleeping. She was in her home sleeping and shot and killed by the police. So if you can't be safe on the streets and you can't be safe in your sleep, then what kind of environment are we, you know, really touting when we say that, you know, that there's fairness? There's no fairness. At least Derek Chauvin was somewhat held accountable. You know, nothing has happened with Breonna Taylor's murder.
But if I could just jump in and add one last thing quickly, compared to what's happened to Breonna Taylor and what happened to George Floyd with what we've seen in the videos from January 6th. Look at the restraint the cops are showing. The cops have body armor. They are well armed and they're not really doing much. They're getting beaten up, but they're not really fighting back. And we know what the protests, the George Floyd protests, look like.
And add to the fact that the Supreme Court has said that the police have no constitutional duty to protect us.
Yeah.
So you've got that. You've got the fact.
So wait, I need to stop you there because I actually don't know that reference. So can you put a little more behind that, please, Joel?
There was a case in which the police did not protect someone. And so they sued. And the Supreme Court, this was in the last 5 years, actually deemed that the police have no constitutional duty to protect us.
Anybody, no one.
And that was seen in Uvalde just a couple of weeks ago. Right. Mm-hmm. Police didn't do anything. Right.
So sorry, that's the elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas.
Yeah. And so when you take all of these things into consideration, and the thing that I want to make real clear, right, is that when juries let these police officers who, you know, kill Wendell Scott, Wendell Scott, he was put in prison, right? But you know, the guy in Minneapolis Philando Castile, right? When the jury lets these police officers out, right? Those jurors, black, white, and other, are the equivalent of those people standing under the enslaved, those lynching photos. You know, those lynching postcards, when you see those people pointing and saying and laughing and cheering, those are the equivalent, right? That is exactly the same thing. We are looking at the system. The first person on the scene when that police officer shot Wendell Scott was a black police officer who did nothing about it. This is a systemic problem. This is why I say, like, changing the cashier at McDonald's is not going to change the recipe of the burger. We actually have to change the entire system. And it doesn't start with putting in black police chiefs or black mayors or a black president. It doesn't start with that. It is a systemic problem that we cannot fix by making superficial changes, right? And the reason I sound so angry, right, is because I am, right? Like, we are looking at this stuff and we see it. And I see these things. Like, Breonna Taylor did nothing. She was asleep in her house. In Louisville, Kentucky. I don't know I think Kentucky has stand your ground laws, right? That should have protected them at least. But those laws don't apply to black people in the same way they apply to everyone else. And if and when we start doing these things, stuff like Juneteenth doesn't really matter, because it is just symbolic. It is taking the flag down. It is removing the statue. It is saying, okay, racism is solved now. We got a Dr. King holiday. You've had a black president, right? You've had three black people on the Supreme Court. Everything's fine now. But it's absolutely not, because stuff is still burning down. Right.
Yes, you can, Kelly. But hang on just one second. Just for listeners, New York Times, June 27th, 2005, the Supreme Court ruled on Monday that the police did not have a constitutional duty to protect a person from harm, even a woman who had obtained a court issued protective order against a violent husband making an arrest mandatory for a violation. So just to follow up on that, Joel, from earlier, Kelly, go ahead.
I don't even know how to say this. So I feel the same anger that Joel is talking about. I feel that anger deeply. I think all Black people do, or most Black people do. But I also am trying to create or carve out spaces in my life where I'm not constantly having to react to whiteness, white supremacy. So for me, if Juneteenth is a day, several hours, where I can be with my family and I can either go to the beach or be or eat a certain kind of recipe that's been, you know, savored or enjoyed or whatever, where I can say, I'm not thinking about you white people today, like, not today, you know, like sometimes you just need to be able to say, like, I understand that all of this is happening, but I'm going to give myself a reprieve of joy to celebrate, because the enslaved did. They knew their circumstances were not that much better, and yet they celebrated, and yet they sang, and yet they paraded, and yet they put on their best clothes. And I think that's also an important aspect of this, because it's not either or, it's both. You need to be able to have the joy to fortify you for the fight tomorrow, like that continues tomorrow. And I think that we have not been able to find a good balance of like channeling that rage, but also carving out pockets where we're like, no, today we're going to have a good time. Today we're not going to be bothered. But it's so hard because you go to a park and you get policed, right? You try to have a barbecue at the beach and someone's calling the cops. Like, so that joy is so precarious. And that's where the anger and the rage comes, is that even when you get the day, you can't have the day.
All right, so we're going to take a break there. And when we come back up, we will pick up on that theme, both Black joy and the sort of policing of Black joy. I'm Tiziana Dearing. You are listening to Kelly Carter Jackson. That was the last voice you just heard. Renee Graham and Joel Christian Gill on this special Juneteenth episode of Radio Boston. We will be back after a break to pick the conversation back up. Stay tuned for more. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and we are bringing you a special full-hour conversation on Juneteenth. Its history, its important, its importance, its legacy, and where it falls short. Still with us, cartoonist and author Joel Christian Gill, columnist Renee Graham, and Africana Studies professor Kelly Carter Jackson. Before the break, Renee, we had started a conversation about, and I'll use Boston Globe columnist Janae Osterholt's framing Black joy, and both the need and desire for it, but also the policing and shutting down of Black joy. And I'll just come to you to pick up the thread of the conversation before the break, wherever it's kind of speaking to you.
Well, there's a lot to be said here, right? I mean, I personally feel like I've never had difficulty accessing joy. You know, I can know how to have a good time. I can have a good time with my family, my friends, whatever. But there is this always this sense, especially these days, that someone is policing what you're doing. And not necessarily because they wear a badge, but somebody feels like there are too many Black people are together, that they're being a little too loud. What are they up to? Why are they here? That's the policing that I worry about. I worry about it with, again, people who actually have guns and badges, but people who have somehow feel their whiteness has deputized them to constantly track what Black people do in this country, you know, and that they have a need to comment on that. And that's what's really frustrating. You know, I'm always aware of it in a way that I don't even know I was aware of it 20, 30 years ago, but I'm always looking around, like who's staring, who's taking a picture, who's doing what, who might be calling. And, you know, we're not doing anything but gathering together in communion and joy. Mm. And why can't we do that? I'm not worried about groups of white people getting together, although I don't know, after January 6th, I don't know, maybe. But, you know, but I don't see the need for someone to constantly be clocking what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. And that's really frustrating. So when you talk about the idea of police state, I don't know that most white people feel that way. But if you ask a Black person, we feel that way because we're the ones being policed.
Mm. So Renee, Joel, go ahead.
I was going to say, it reminds me like two quotes. One is like the, you know, the famous James Baldwin quote, to be a Negro in this country and relatively conscious is to be angry all the time. Mm. And then the refrain from Jay-Z's song Moonlight, we're stuck in La La Land, even when we win, we're going to lose, right? Mm. Like it feels like that a lot of the time. We get these little steps forward. Right. We get what we think. Right. I had conservative people that I went to high school with after George Floyd saying, I want to have a real conversation with it. And now they're like, critical race theory is bad. Right. So like they've forgotten about all of this stuff. And so like, every little step forward, we get big steps back.
So I also feel like, well, it's not just the policing, it's also the exploitation. So like we saw just a couple of weeks ago when, you know, Walmart tried to come out with this Juneteenth ice cream and they had the Juneteenth paper plates and the napkins that said, it's the freedom for me. You know, all of these things were like, wait, what? There's merch, right? Like think about how this movement also gets exploited by those who are trying to cash in on the good feelings, cash in on the holiday that does not translate to Black sales.
So that's
how predatory capitalism comes into play as well, right? This is exactly it. Predatism, like capitalism, takes this stuff, and you have corporations and companies and people who what is Walmart doing for the Black community, right? They're just capitalizing on this one thing, right? So like they're basically, you know, like capitalism actually is a problem in a sense, right? Because we don't have any structures or real understanding about how we can deal with these issues without like people just saying, oh, we're just going to put out a Martin Luther King t-shirt and call it a day.
So I want to,
it's also a feeling that Juneteenth didn't need the validation of this. Mm. We were celebrating it regardless. And what it really doesn't need to be is gentrified.
Mm. So there, okay. I want to pick up on that thread because I want to be, all right. First, we are having a conversation about the Black experience in America and anti-Blackness in America. And I am not, what I'm about to do is not to what about this. I want to be very clear. Well, what about this? I do want to be mindful that we are having this conversation about Juneteenth and the Black experience in America during another month, which is Pride Month. And in fact, that some of the arc of what you have talked about commercialization, exploitation, as well as societal pushback against progress are arguments and experiences that people in the LGBTQ community in Pride Month would say that echoes my experience. Mm-hmm. So I want to mark that. And Renee, you nodded. Let me turn to you to reflect on that for a moment.
Well, look, we know that at this point, lots of companies and corporations realize there's a lot of money to be made by putting rainbows on everything. But we also know that these are the same companies that continue to donate money to anti-LGBTQ candidates. So that's exploitation at its root. We can make money off these people, but we don't really care about their lives or their rights.
Do you have any specific examples that come to mind of that, Renee?
Oh my goodness, AT&T is notorious for, you know, lots of commercials and good things with same-sex couples, but they give money to anti-LGBTQ candidates all the time. You can even just look at just what happened after January 6th, when it's like all these companies decided, we're not going to give money. Well, most of those companies are now giving money again to those same people who might have been conspirators in what happened on January 6th. And that happens every single June. You see all of these places that really don't give a damn about LGBTQ lives, but they see that there's money to be made. And so you will go in and you will see the pride section and you will see the rainbow flags and you will see all this stuff. And you see them at the pride parades. Pride parades have become incredibly corporate. You know, banks, insurance companies, and again, places that do not necessarily care about your life the other 11 months of the year.
So I will say though that, because I don't want somebody to call me out, every year I go to Target and I get my kids like the Black History Month t-shirts that have like the Frederick Douglass or the Malcolm X. I love it. It was only until recently though that I found out that Target had been working with Black cotton farmers to sell those t-shirts so that the money was going back into the pockets of Black entrepreneurs. That is a model I can get with. That is a model I wholeheartedly buy what you are selling. But I do think that in the case of Walmart and in the case of these other companies that are really, you know, trying to make a dollar and exploit, you know, Black people's desire to have certain decorations or what have you for the holiday, it becomes conflicted. Like, do I really need these Juneteenth plates from Walmart? You know, like, who was getting this money? And in the case of the ice cream, they totally ripped off a Black woman who sold this red velvet cream cheese ice cream and sort of played it off as their own concoction. I have a problem with that.
Also, let me just add, just as an idea about the idea of queerness in America as a cis straight man, like how, like, queerness is like okay if you're white, And, you know, like that is evident in the fact that Caitlyn Jenner comes out and they put her on the cover of Vogue as if Janet Mook and Laverne Cox never existed. Right. Mm. Like, so like
you and remind our listeners who Janet and Laverne were.
Janet and Laverne are Black trans women who've been like living their lives in the open for decades. You know, mm-hmm. Janet Mock wrote a book about it. Laverne Cox has been on television.
The Post TV show they put together.
Yeah. I mean, just like these are amazing. Again, we have a hierarchy of queerness in America. Right. If you are a Black trans woman, you are at the absolute bottom. Right. And there's no. It's not a coincidence that Black is the intersectionality of that, right? That's not a coincidence, right? Like, you know, like the idea that like in America, like people always talk to me about this and they're, you know, they're saying, Joel, if you just stop talking about, like, I've actually had this happen to me. Joel, if you stop talking about race, it won't, you know, like you just stop bringing it up. Why do I got to keep hearing about it, right? Like as if America will not remind me that I am a 6-foot Black man when I get into an elevator with a bunch of white people. Right. Like that. Well, it's always going to remind me. And if and until we get to that time when we start dealing with the original sin in America, right, which is the creation of the race concept that was then exported across the world. Once we get to a situation where we have dealt with that, then we can move toward a colorblind society, because race complicates every time we talk about these things. Right? Race complicates capitalism. Marx said race was a capitalist, like America, that we had a bourgeoisie capitalist system where race was the issue. Marx said that, you know, Marx said this, you know, 150 years ago, right? And we still have not dealt with these things. We haven't dealt with the fact that in order for there to be winners and losers in capitalism, you have to have losers. And because race is the issue that complicates that, mm-hmm. Black people, brown people, queer people are the losers, right? And until we deal with these things, we're going to continue to have these problems, and we're not going to be able to celebrate Juneteenth, because I'm going to be mad about it. I'm going to be mad thinking that I got killed and I'm still in jail.
Yeah. All right. So two things. First, I just want to note the ice cream reference. The company is it's an ice cream company, Creamalicious, founded by Cincinnati-based chef Liz Rogers. And there was accusation that the Walmart ice cream was too similar to an ice cream produced there. I appreciate you engaging with me on the question of Pride Month. And you've made a funny transition there, Joel, because where I wanted to go next was, so how do we celebrate Juneteenth? And you, of course, you just said, we don't, because I'm still angry. But if you can indulge.
We do.
Okay, all right, Kelly.
I say we
you're
do.
You're my next person.
So, you know, I'm
going to be crying eating the ice cream, right? That's what it's going to happen. I'm going to be eating ice cream. Crying.
That is, I mean, that's fair. That's legit. I think that what I've been telling my students is that February is Black History Month. I look at June as Black Futures Month. I look at June as an opportunity to say, how do we think about the world that we want to live in? What should the world look like? And how can we fight for those things? So traditionally, if you look at June, people used it as a voter registration day where people could say, hey, listen, midterms are coming. We're going to have this barbecue and here's a form, register to vote. Or in case of the pandemic, hey, you know, this is a good time to get vaccinated. If you've not gotten vaccinated, let's use Juneteenth as a way to get people active and to give them information so that while we're celebrating, we can also be doing something that helps to work for change, whether it's a petition or whether it's, you know, a campaign stump. There are ways I think that we can make the holiday work for us in creating the world that we want to live in.
And Renee, I just say, I always feel torn about that, because the same way that MLK Day has become like a day of service, you know, and there have been pushes and people are already talking about making Juneteenth into something more. I feel like, why are holidays always got to be high minded? Like, why can't we just have a holiday? Why can't we just get together with our friends and barbecue and listen to Frankie Beverly and Maze and just have a good time? Right.
Count me in.
Understand that there's, you know, there's always more to be done. And if when we have people together, if you can get that next thing done, if you can get people vaccinated, if you can get people to register to vote, if you can do these other things, if you can get them to call their congresspeople and talk to them about what's happening in schools, then that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I would like for black people to take that time to barbecue and listen to Frankly Beverly and Maze. And I would like white people to put in the service. I would like white people to stop being guilty and be just as angry as the rest of us. Like, we don't need white guilt. What we need is white anger. And we need white anger at the unfairness of the system, because not this system does not just affect black people. Right. There is intersectionality. Right. So poor white people who are more, there are more poor white people in America than poor black people are getting just getting as affected by these things as we are. And so until they stop aligning themselves with white supremacy and aligning themselves with people who are out to get them and being angry about the things that have helped black people that are harming black people, because the same things that are harming black people. When I say 40% of the population of prisons are black, the other 60% are white, and they don't need to be there either, right? So like, we still have these issues. And until we get people to like, don't be guilty, don't be sad, don't look at, you know, second place trophies as like, I'm talking about Confederate statues, as like the thing that we need to do, look at the system and saying this system is not working for everybody and it needs to work for everybody and be angry. Let us barbecue. Don't call 911. Let us have a barbecue. And y'all go out and register people to vote. Y'all go out and do these to bring down the system, because the only other option is to burn the whole thing down.
Just going to flag, I see your point, Joel. We do have people in the American prison system of other races and ethnicities as well. And I just could hear listeners saying, wait, there's other representation there too that on another day we need to take up. Talk about as well. All right, Renee, we've got about 45 seconds left. You are my media pro. I am giving you, I think, the last word, unless you're short, and then I'm going to turn to somebody else.
I mean, you know, Juneteenth is an important day. It says a lot that this country has never had a day that has marked the end of the Civil War. I think there should be a John Brown holiday. I think it's really disgusting. Yes. They haven't had these things, right? So it is an important day, but understand the history of it. You know, understand what's going on, what happened then, but also what's happening now, and make a move to make Juneteenth count by making its history available to everyone.
Mm-hmm. All right. And on that note, I think we will call it. I cannot thank you enough for this level of engagement and wisdom and passion. That last voice you heard was Renee Graham, opinion columnist and associate editor at the Boston Globe. We've also had Joel Christian Gill, cartoonist, historian, and associate professor at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design, and Kelly Carter Jackson, associate professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Just what a barn burner of a conversation. Thank you to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting me yell for a bit.
Can I say one last thing? And if you're going to play Before I Let Go at the barbecue, play Frankie Beverly's version, not Beyonce's.
All right, there you go. And that is our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thank you so much for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
You made me happy.